Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Economic and Business History, a new podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm Ghassan Moazin, one of the hosts on the channel. And today we'll be talking to Dr. John D. Wong, an associate professor at the University of Hong Kong. And we'll be talking about his recent book called Global Trade in the 19th Century, The House of Hokwa, and the Canton System, which came out with Cambridge University Press and is a fascinating study of China's global trade connections during the late 18th and early 19th century, both with Europe and the United States. So, John, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off, I, as always, I wanted to ask you, sort of before we dig into the book more specifically, I wanted to ask you how you actually came to the study of modern China and global trade, how we ended up studying this particular area of history.
Well, that's a great question. Usually when we talk about careers, we make it sound very logical, that it is the path of progression that takes us here. But then in reality, there are lots of twists and turns. There certainly were plenty in my case. And in my situation, I have become a business historian by way of economics, career, investment, and study of history. I think that background has actually been quite helpful because it reminds me of contingencies when I do my own writing of history. But then if we were to think about work that I've done, the one thing seems to have remained constant, and that's my interest in Hong Kong and the Pearl River Delta area, now reincarnated as the Greater Bay Area. Maybe I can just give you a little bit more details about this path. I was born and raised in Hong Kong, and like any good native child of this city, I pursued a pragmatic career-oriented path. So I left Hong Kong to go to school in the US, and there I studied economics. I did what was expected of me, investment banking and then investment management for a while. But then in my 30s, I decided to pursue something more intellectually stimulating. So I signed up for evening classes where I lived and chanced upon a course offered by the late Philip Kuhn. For that class, we read his book, Soul Stealers, and I was quite inspired by his brand of history writing as storytelling. And as I worked with him, I also developed an interest in studying the Chinese diaspora or overseas Chinese. And at that point, I decided to go back to school full time. And once I was back in school, it was actually wonderful, but yet at the same time, a little bit bewildering, because I was blessed with the breadth of courses offered in graduate school, did everything from early China to more contemporary history of China. In fact, my first publication was on early China, and in that I examined territorial treatises in the Warring States era and to explore how early thinkers imagined the expanse of the emerging empire and how they talked about the margins of the empire. What soon dawned on me was that, well, all of China was interesting, but I was more interested in the South, particularly the Pearl River Delta area. and how that region had served as an interface between the political power in the north and the maritime world in Nanyang, or today's Southeast Asia, and even beyond. What was also tricky at that moment is that, though, I realized that you can take a person out of business, but not the business out of a person. So I found topics of business history in particular resonating with me as I studied Chinese history. And I could relate to historical actors in transnational businesses more. So why I became a business historian of China.
Oh, wonderful, wonderfully interesting. And certainly one of many people. I mean, that seems to be super lucky to be directly be able to study with Philip Kuhn during those evening classes, but certainly one of many people that got to the study of modern China through his works. Now, having sort of learned about that a bit, obviously the particular book that we're discussing today deals with Guangzhou or Canton in the late 18th, early 19th century, and with a particular person, Hou Kua, this sort of famous Chinese merchant at the time. So I wonder whether you could talk a bit about how you actually got to this topic and why you chose this particular topic in graduate school and then later also for your first book.
Sure. Well, in graduate school, I worked with many scholars, all of whom were kind enough to allow me plenty of latitude. On my dissertation committee alone, there were experts not just of Chinese history, but also a scholar of Southeast Asia, a specialist in business history, and an international financial historian. So the world is your oyster when it comes to research topics, but that's liberating and at the same time terrifying. My advisor, Michael Zoni, he is equally at ease tackling topics on China during the Ming Dynasty, as well as writing on 20th century China. So the choice of topic is tricky, but I think graduate school gives you a decent process of that when you have to look at the specific debates in your field. And what I was most impressed with in terms of the debates that we had to look at during that whole process was this whole issue of the Great Divergence, how China and the West apparently developed on different economic paths. Why am I interested in that? Well, that topic does not just bring together economics and history, but also bridges Chinese history and make it relevant to world history, which in most cases is basically a study of the West. And that was also at that particular moment so that I understand what appeals to me the most. I appreciate aggregate data, but aggregate data for certain buckets that would make appropriate units for comparison. But what was more interesting to me was how about the feet on the ground? Who were the actual historical actors animating historical developments that aggregated to what we know as economic history? We understand from scholarship that the divide happened maybe around 18th century or so. So who were actually driving that particular development? Now, back to my interest in the Greater Bay Area or the Pearl River Delta, you know, Canton was the trading port in the Asian region for that particular period. So, you know, I decided on the Canton system as a lens through which I could explore this whole issue of the Great Divergence. And to think about the Canton system, I mean, I can give you the specific dates, you know, how it became the sole port of call in 1757 and it continued on till the Opium War that ushered in the treaty port era. But I think it's important for us to understand that as part of China's longstanding expansive trading network, of course, that included overland trade along the northern borders, the junk trade in East Asia, as well as exchange with Nanyang generated by the Chinese diaspora. And in addition, in particular for the Canton system, is trade with partners from afar, in particular, increasing European maritime traffic in the 18th century. I was certainly not the first to study the China trade of that period. There was a lot of existing scholarship. As we say, you know, all history is contemporary history. So if you were to look at the history or the research on the China trade, it started in the early 20th century with some groundbreaking works that cataloged the various Hong merchant families, some by their own descendants. And by the 1980s, as China reopened for business, there was renewed interest. The focus at that time, though, was the financially troubled Chinese traders. And the usual explanation for their plight was extraction of the Qing state or incompetence of individual merchants overbearing Western partners. There was another turn, though, around the turn of the millennium. The focus shifted to transnational trade. And in particular, a scholar who, Paul Van Dyke, who first taught in Macau and then moved to Canton or Guangzhou, he focuses mostly on the 18th century. And that was a period that's a little bit different from my focus. And the reason for that is that the 18th century was a little bit more multilingual. It involved more European, continental European languages. I decided, well, if he has done so much on the 18th century, maybe I can move on to the 19th, and so I did. And by the 19th century, you can see that continental European powers have waned, in at least in the China trade, largely as a result of the political and military turmoil in continental Europe. Just to give you some figures, the rise of the British traders was at the expense of continental European rivals. 1775, the British East India Company accounted for less than 22% of total tea exports from Canton, behind the Dutch's 30%, and not substantially ahead of Danes' 17%. Dial forward to 1793, the British commanded an overwhelming 79%. Of the trade. So, you know, it was actually the Western context in which, you know, the Chinese merchant Ho Kwa that I focus on in the book emerged. And what was interesting in his case was that when you have the waning of continental European powers, you have the arrival of another player. In this case, the newly independent United States, dispatching enterprising traders newly liberated from the monopoly of the China trade. And their arrival was timely and facilitated, because of the shared language, a smooth transition for Ho Kwa and his China traders to work with Western traders arriving in Canton.
Yeah, great. Fantastic. Yeah, I think... I was just thinking about I think you have a wonderful graph in your book that exactly shows how from the 18th century you have sort of more of a mixture of trading partners in Canton, and that really then moves over to an obvious dominance of the British East India Company. I think you've already wonderfully dived in and sort of taken us into your book and what you're looking at, the sort of dynamics between foreign and Chinese merchants. But I wondered, especially because I think many people probably working not too familiar with the Chinese scene or South China at that time might actually not exactly know what the Canton system is. So I was wondering whether you could just talk a bit about, you know, what exactly is the Canton system? Why was Chinese trade with the West focused on Canton? And who were the main players? Of which Ho Kwa was obviously one of them, but who were sort of the main groups of merchants or economic players that we see in Canton?
Sure. Well, the concentration or the aggregation of trade in Canton was more of a balancing act on the part of the Qing court. They needed to figure out how to police the trade, to regulate the trade, yet at the same time not quite destroy the economic dynamism from which they were generating significant revenues, and it was mounting in the 18th century. And many of the Chinese merchants trading in Canton at that time, quite a few of the families, were not even from the Guangdong area. So Ho Kwa's family, the Wus, were not the first. They were preceded by, well, in terms of the more successful cases, the Pans, the Pan Kikwas, who were said to have traveled around Southeast Asia, going as far as Manila, picked up some Spanish and English along the way, and that made it easy for them to partner with continental European merchants in the 18th century. Then you have the arrival of Ho Kwa's family, you know, also from outside of Guangdong. They were from Fujian. The Wu family was said to have arrived in Canton in the late 17th century, probably as the Qing court was trying to consolidate control of the southern coast and provinces. And in with Ho Kwa's emergence in the closing decades of the 18th century, you have him, along with his brother, starting trade in Canton in the early 1790s. And they quickly rose to prominence, so much so that by 1798, their family represented 18% of the British East India Company's business. And when his brother died in 1801, Ho Kwa became the assumed total control of the family's business. And that was when the Pons and some of the other leading players were exiting the business. And hence, Ho Kwa and his firm became basically the monopolist in the last decades of the Canton system in terms of China's export of tea to the Western world.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I think that's important to note. So the commodities we are sort of talking about are, in your case, particularly tea, but of course then opium comes in sort of as a remedy because the Westerners don't really have anything else. You know, they have furs and cotton and somewhat, but they don't have anything else quite as that is quite as sought out by the Chinese as the Westerners want tea, and therefore they switch. They bring in opium then. So sort of the next point that I really found interesting was that you describe in quite a bit of detail, particularly in the second chapter of your book, the relationship that Ho Kwa sort of, or the Ho Kwa firm basically builds up with the British East India Company. Mm-hmm. And the ways in which, I mean, as you say, obviously it became they became sort of an important trading partner for the East India Company. But in the chapter, you also describe how Ho Kwa then sort of starts to actually finance the East India Company, and in that way builds some kind of leverage over them. So I wonder whether you can talk a bit more about what was the relationship between Ho Kwa, this Chinese merchant, and the British East India Company. What was sort of the power relationship, and how did Ho Kwa try to manage this particular relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were certainly very symbiotic during that period. And that relationship grew over time and certainly built on the material exchange that came to be in the Canton trade. You are certainly right to say that the Western traders were trying to balance things off by having something to import into China. I think it's also quite interesting to note that tea became such a global commodity. I'm not sure if we know yet why that's the case or how that came about. Of course, it certainly helps to have a certain addictive quality to it, that you can have a recurring annual trade that you need to go back to Canton for, because at that moment, you could only source tea from China. And it's not for the lack of trying that the British and then the Americans decided on opium in the end, which was yet another addictive substance for sure, with a lot more harmful effects on the body. But before that, they tried various things. In the British case, they sent in woolens because of the amounts that they produced in England. And in the British, in the American case, they tried all sorts of things. They tried fur for a while, which, living in Hong Kong, I'm constantly reminded of all these rich ladies trying to put on some fur on Chinese New Year on the 2 days when the temperature drops below, I don't know, 20 degrees Celsius. So that didn't quite work. And for a while, they were trying to look for comparable commodities as well. The Americans found what they thought was ginseng in America to complement what people found to be quite scarce in China. But then, as we know, American ginseng isn't quite the same as Korean or Manchurian ginseng, and that didn't quite work. But before opium, though, what seemed to have worked, and that's something that I think we have largely overlooked, was that silver in and of itself was also a commodity that's traded. We tend to flatten silver to just the weight that was transported from one place to another. But then that was also a commodity that had its own exchange rates or prices as well, because they were not all created equal. Chinese tael is not quite the same as Spanish silver coin. And even for that, different brands, different mints had different prices. And there was a vibrant market for that in Canton and beyond. So that was the context in which Hokua was working with the British East India Company. Tea was the commodity that underwrote the recurring arrival of the British and other Western merchants into Canton. But then they were struggling to figure out the other side of the trade. And when opium became the obvious choice for basically the commodity to complete the circuit, it was a tricky business. Not all merchants were allowed to, could openly trade in opium. Well, no one could, but certain people face heavier fines, like the Hong merchants, the Hokuas, and his Chinese compatriots. And on the British side, you have the emergence of the private traders as well, doing that part of the business. So you can see how messy the situation was, that Hokua needed to rely on the dominance of British East India Company to come back year in and year out to buy tea from him, while at the same time trying to circumvent British hegemony. And in that case, it was the arrival of the Americans. But then the Americans were not quite the same as the British. The British East India Company was a well-oiled machinery. So that's why when you look at their business records, you see their formulaic entries scripted on nice heavy paper. The Americans, new arrivals, so you see more of their business records, but mostly personal letters penned on flimsy paper written front and back sideways. The hardship of the merchant spending time in a faraway land to earn what they call a competence for the trip back home. And it was Hokua's leverage of the Americans that helped him create at least some sort of a balance with the British at that time. And the way he did that was by consigning tea to America. So the dynamics of trade was totally different. With the British, he had basically a contractual amount that he delivered to them at a fixed price. With the Americans, he sent probably not the the first quality, the top quality of tea, but boatloads of it to America, where his partners would then sell for him at the prevailing market prices to the American market.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, and I think that's also where the whole Hokua tea brand even comes from. Then I think that some people might be familiar with. But as you sort of brought up the Americans now, I think what is really absolutely interesting in your book is the relationship that you obviously described that is sort of built up between particular American traders and the House of Hokua. And I mean, you particularly talk about one individual that is John Perkins Cushing and Perkins & Co., and of course also the Forbes family. So I was wondering whether you could talk a bit more, not just about their business relationship, but also about the personal relationship that obviously existed, because it was not the case that Hokua just sort of did business with any American traders, but he had a very particular sort of partnership that he struck with few select people on the American side. So I wonder whether you could talk a bit more about that.
Sure. Well, Cushing and also the Forbes were certainly instrumental in Hokua's business plan. Maybe a word on the transition, though. I mean, he was trying to get out from under the British control. And how do you do it? I mean, you cannot just hire a British linguist to help translate for you. And it's because the Americans spoke basically the same language as the British that facilitated that particular transition. Hokua didn't speak English. He speak what was called pidgin. And from some of the documents that I've gathered on the Forbes, we know that pidgin actually is basically a corrupt form of saying business. And when I read that, I could only picture an old grandma in Hong Kong or in this part of the world trying to teach them to say the word business, and pidgin might be what you'll get. So they spoke pidgin. In other words, they spoke business. And what's interesting, though, that in that case is that, well, they didn't need to speak standard English. There's nothing that needed to be so standard about that, so long as you can get your point across. And so you can see a sense of priority of what is what is important to them. So in that particular period of trade, that was a very peculiar feature. And in the case of Hokwa, what was crucial to his success was that he basically had by his side either John Perkins Cushing's or one of the Forbes brothers in Canton for much of the period, or actually for all the whole period leading up to the Opium War. So there was a continuous chain of trusted the confidants that he had by his side, who was working with someone else on the American side of the world, dealing in tea and reporting back to Canton of the conditions, not just of the tea market, but also the financial market, you know, what you can get for bills of exchange at one particular place or silver in a different place. And that underwrote the business success of Hokwa during his lifetime, and as I continued in the rest of the book, even past his lifetime, because that's a relationship that facilitated capital exchange back to Canton all the way to the 1890s. Now, it was not really for the lack of trying that Hokwa focused on just one particular family or one group of cousins. Before that, Hokwa traded with quite a few other American merchants. And some of them, because of the difficulties in Canton and also back home, absconded back to the U.S. And that was actually an interesting episode because it tells you how, well, before the emergence of an international court of arbitration, Hokwa did resort to some of the U.S. courts to see if he could recoup some of the money that his debtors actually carry with them back to the U.S. But then he and his trusted advisors, I think at that time was Cushing, decided not to go after the bankrupt debtors relentlessly. In other words, not to throw good money after bad. So that's also a reminder that trusted advisors are important to you. Legal regimes, sure, but legal channels was just a useful resource and not necessarily a prime consideration. In essence, legal remedies was a last resort. You need personal relations to get the business to function the way it did.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I think that speaks actually to, I think, a larger point that I really got from when reading the book is that obviously, particularly in Chinese business history, there has been quite a lot of research on sort of looking into the long tradition of contracts in China and trying to sort of figure out well, first of all, how these contracts exactly functioned in a business context, but also sort of trying to see whether or not this might be, you know, the way that contracts were used and compared to the West, whether that might be able to help us explain a bit more about the divergent economic development in the West and China. But I think from your book, what I found was really interesting was that you contrast this very much with personal trust and make very clearly the point that, yes, you have these legal institutions, you have business institutions that are structured in a certain way, but in the end, building up this personal trust between the different business partners across the world and maintaining it, that is really, really the key. So I wonder whether you could, in terms of how you describe these sort of global trading networks, whether you could talk a bit about or discuss a bit what the role of personal trust in all of that really played.
Yeah, personal trust seems to be a term that people would find a little bit nebulous, you know, just like, you know, what is culture? But, you know, I think it's actually not that different from the way we talk about credit now. It's turned into more of an ossified form of giving you a credit rating. But then credit just is trust among the various partners. And what is the mechanism of policing that credit system, I think, is the most important. Back to the case of Hokwa, as we mentioned just now, is the constant presence of someone representing the other side of your alliance sitting by your side. I mean, you're not holding that person hostage, but then that's a constant way of reporting back to you what is going on to the extent possible, because letter exchange took time at that in that particular period. But this constant update, this sense of trust that you develop with individuals and by extension to their relatives is important. And I think a lot of times we tend to reduce it to people of common ethnicities or religious backgrounds. Those are important. To the extent that it created chances of recurring interactions, constant interactions. But then if you can do it and function in a different way, well, you can make friends not necessarily of your same ethnicity or religion. And in this case, I guess they have the shared belief in profit-making, and that helped Hokwa and his American partners function for decades ahead of the Opium War and beyond, in a way that's a little bit different from his interactions with the East India Company. That was a well-established institution, and he needed to figure out how to outsmart them financially. In the case of the Americans, it's the constant assessment of risk that he was undertaking, either because of the credit of his American partners or the risk of price fluctuations as tea was getting shipped to America. When the world was that fluid, I think that sense of trust was just all the more important.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one point that you just made is very important that we sort of pull out this, because I think there's still very much this idea, you know, Western traders, rational sort of kind of individuals that use contracts and so on to do business. And then, as you say, you have sort of, it's almost as if we connect personal trust to certain ethnicities and saying then, you know, the Chinese use personal trust. But obviously, as you show in the book, I think very convincingly that actually, in particular, you know, in these sort of transnational exchanges, that personal trust becomes really important. I mean, I think there's one point in there that I really would ask you to talk a bit more about, and that is the use of portraits. Mm-hmm. And Hokwa sort of, even though he himself never actually left China, but his portrait certainly did. And sort of the way, you know, I just thought it was wonderfully interesting the way that he used his own portraits to sort of be omnipresent in a sense and sort of maintain a relationship to the Americans. I wonder whether you could discuss a bit more so how you came to sort of focus and discuss this at some length in the book.
I guess the genesis of that is the study of these export paintings by our art friends in art history, and I find that to be quite interesting. Probably because of my business background, I felt that wow, that's basically brand making. In the case of Hokwa, you're right to say that he projected this omnipresence among his trusted partners when they returned to America with that portrait. But then he did that even beyond that circle as his portrait circulated on both sides of the Atlantic with other potential business partners as well. Actually, I found a couple of them in India because that was part of the network of trade. And so, you know, you just need to project your presence far and wide. And in his case, without leaving Canton, that was that was quite ingenious. So one can say that before there was the Marlboro Man or the Colonel in Kentucky Fried Chicken, or even the Apple in Apple, you have this brand of Hoquar, and maybe even more powerful than some of the more modern brands, because there was that personal connection that this particular brand image signified for the various partners and prospective allies that he could work with. Another part that I think I might have mentioned in the book, but not as forcefully, is his signature as well. We talked about contracts. A contract is no good unless you sign it and you execute it in a particular form. And again, if you have to look back at that period of transnational exchange in the early 19th century in Canton, well, what is proper form then? How do you even sign your name? And in the case of the Hong merchants, you have some insisting on the old Chinese way of a chop, a seal, and then maybe a certain scribble with a brush. And then on the side of the Western traders, maybe the regular signature with a pen. It is not uncommon for us to see in surviving documents from that period, Hoquar's signature spelled out his name as is written in some of the contracts, H-O-U-Q-U-A, all painted with his brush, this Chinese brush, signed that way. I guess it takes a little bit of guts to do that. I mean, I'm not sure if I would sign my name on a document in a foreign language, my name in a foreign language as well. But then, well, when you do the risk assessment, you can see how he assessed the contents of the document. And, well, if I were to sign my name in English, you take it to a U.S. court of law, I certainly would make good on it, but it's not really anything that is different from the way a Chinese contract was supposed to work in China. So you have this particular transnational dimension of the story. And in the case of his signature, it was even more interesting than the portrait itself, because that intersects with this whole notion of a legal document and the criticality of one signature on a piece of paper.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, I think, that seems to be quite odd in a sense. I would have also thought that the chop would have been more prevalent still at that time. But certainly, yes, that is very, very interesting. I think as we sort of talk about Hoquar, one thing that we should probably, again, particularly for people that might not be that familiar with the Canton system, should probably discuss is, Hoquar was one of the Hong merchants who had sort of the monopoly on doing trade with the Westerners in Canton. But he was obviously quite an exceptional individual. If you had to sort of compare him to his other colleagues, other Hong merchants, how would you rate him? How would you compare him to them? Because I think that's quite important to sort of highlight in a sense.
Sure. That's the usual challenge of the book. You know, how representative was Hoquar and how should we think about him in the context of the other Hong merchants? The simple answer is, I guess, if you were to look at the popularization of personal computers, it's tough to not talk about Bill Gates, even though there are a lot of other failed cases of software developers. Similar with talking about, say, electric cars or the internet, you have your iconic figures. Now, how would I then understand Hoquar in the context of the other Hong merchants? As I alluded to earlier, there were other successful Hong merchants before him. The challenges were quite different. In the 18th century, not only do you need to figure out how to work with English-speaking people, but then sometimes English-speaking people who did not necessarily get along, and hence your entree into playing one against the other. But then in the 18th century, you need to do it across languages, and the Pans were very successful at that. By the 19th century, Hoquar was not the only Hong merchant who signed his name with a brush in English. Consequa was another one. And unfortunately, that Hong family was not quite as good at assessing risk, especially across long distances with multiple partners, and was not as successful financially. Now, how would I think of Hokwa vis-a-vis the other successful Hong merchants? They lived in different periods of time. To me, the Pons were outrageously successful because not only did they make a lot of money, with a lot of difficulties, they managed to ease all of the trade. In a way, Hokwa never managed to, because Hokwa died in 1843. And of course, we know the Opium War happened towards the end of his life. That was a lot more difficult. And in Hokwa's case, it's also quite peculiar compared to some of the other merchant families as well, in that he lived a rather long life. So the other merchant families might have had different generations in the trade. Hokwa did, but only alongside of his brother, who worked with him for a decade, and he was supposed to be succeeded by some of his sons, but then he outlived many of them. He outlived but two of them. So it was basically him running the business alongside his American partners for this whole time, and that relationship that he developed with the American partners basically extended this whole idea of a merchant family beyond just your natural birthrights and bonds. So in that sense, I think he was quite a special case as compared to as compared with some of the other Hong merchant families, and deserves the study that hopefully mine did in giving him credit for his success in the China trade.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing to probably also highlight is certainly, I mean, I'm not an expert on the Canton system, but I think a lot of the literature also talks, previous literature rather, talks about the Hong merchants rather in a negative light, that they were, you know, there were a lot of bankruptcies, many of them were not successful. So I think highlighting one of the, you know, that this model could, that the Chinese merchants did succeed and did compete and cooperate, not just from an inferior position, but also from a you know, with a lot of agency with their Western counterparts. I think that's another reason why this case is certainly deserves a proper treatment that it gets in your book, certainly.
Yeah, that's I think the motivation I had in writing the book, and of course I'd have got against more of a triumphalism type of attitude, because I did this research when China was once again re-emerging as a global power. But then to write off all previous business successes of Chinese merchants was equally wrong. And I hope that the story of Hokwa restores some of the balance there. We need to understand that before the imposition of what we now know as international standards, which primarily products of the West, we need to understand that there was a more dynamic system of exchange, more fluid, in which Chinese were pivotal players. And as you pointed out, I mean, if Hokwa was a capital source even for the East India Company, the British East India Company, the balance of power was not quite as lopsided as I think some earlier studies might have suggested. And it's important for us to understand the Chinese merchants at that particular moment without the lens of a later period.
No, absolutely. I think that comes out really, really strongly in your study. Just now, you obviously mentioned the Opium War, and I think the first Opium War, and we need to sort of start, that is quite a turning point, obviously. I mean, also because Hokwa obviously died in 1843, but I wonder whether, yes, you can discuss a bit what difference the Opium War made to the trading networks that Hokwa had built up, and also what happens to the family business after Hokwa's passing, and then and that's obviously connected then with the rise of the treaty port system after the First Opium War.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the challenge of doing the humanities as opposed to natural sciences. There's no experiment we could run. There's no control that we could have. Hokwa did die right when the Opium War ended and the Canton system was concluding. So it's tough to separate his passing from the effect of the change of the system from the Canton-based network to more of a treaty port system. But as I tried to do in the later part of the book, you can see that even with his son, who is not quite as much of an entrepreneurial spirit as Ho Kwa himself, the importance of Canton lingered, partly because of the connections that people built there, partly because where the money was. I mean, Ho Kwa's family did hold on to a lot of financial resources, both within the city and beyond. So you can see traders coming back to Canton. As a matter of fact, some of the interesting documents showed up because you have the rearrival of a Forbes cousin in Canton, looking up Ho Kwa's son, trying to reestablish contact. And from that contact, maybe Ho Kwa's family did not become as much of the driver of the trade, directing traffic, steering development. But then they were very powerful providers of capital to some of these Western merchants, the Forbes in particular. Hence the discussion I had about the lingering investments that Ho Kwa's family made in Russell & Company and the Forbes. And that continued in spite of subsequent struggles, the Second Opium War, Taiping Rebellion. And that ends off actually not because, not only because Ho Kwa's family was facing difficulties, but also because the Americans themselves were not having their own financial struggle. And as the Russell & Company enterprise dissolved in the 1890s, that was actually the eventual conclusion to that particular partnership, you know, almost five decades after Ho Kwa's death. And I think I focus on that story to highlight a couple of things. One, perhaps is the more inward-looking posture of Ho Kwa's descendants after his death in 1843. And perhaps it is the proliferation of treaty ports. But all these factors did contribute to what we know as the treaty port era. But that did not happen right away. So if we think about fluidity of the exchange before, we also need to reconsider how rigidly we can define the periodization of the Canton system versus the treaty port era, and how quickly the switch was switched. It was not quite as much of an abrupt transformation of the system as I guess we would like to believe.
Yeah, interesting. That's always an interesting juncture in any kind of family business, I guess. Sort of the change over to the next generation, and then seeing how the next generation manages to sort of hold on to or emulate the last generation, or rather not, or how they do the things differently and what the consequences are. Again, you just touched upon something that I think we definitely have to discuss, at least at some somewhat a bit, and that's like what you discuss in the sixth chapter of your book, and that's what you call the Swiss bank account, quote unquote, of Ho Kwa and his investments in the U.S. I think that's really something that you know, that certainly people working on global trade, but also I think on sort of American history in the, you know, early 19th century, probably have no idea about. But it comes out, you know, you wonderfully track sort of Ho Kwa's investments in the U.S., even beyond his death. So I wonder whether you can, talk a bit about, you know, how did he come to invest some of his money in the U.S.? Who was handling that investment, and how did the Ho Kwa family benefit from this?
Sure. Well, the genesis of that is actually a boatload of goods that he had shipped on consignment to America during the Opium War. And originally, Ho Kwa himself had wanted the money to be repatriated to Canton. But to keep it from the prying eyes of the Qing court, he decided at the end to leave it in America under the care of John Murray Forbes. And that became the basis of what was known as the ASI, American Stock Investment, that John managed for Ho Kwa and then subsequently his family. I think before I looked at the details of the transactions, other people have notice this particular investment of Ho Kwa's family, the Wu families, in America. But it's also easy to overblow the instrumentality thereof, in particular his choice of investment. Yes, Hoqua's family did invest in American railroads. Hoqua's family did invest in American government bonds at a time when America was having some domestic trouble of its own, in the same time as the Taiping Rebellion. But then that was not really Hoqua's family's doing. It was Hoqua's trusted advisor, John Murray Forbes, investing on behalf of Hoqua and his family. Basically guarding the assets from the extraction that might have been happening in Canton at that time. And as trouble mounted, financial troubles mounted for Hoqua's family, part of the money got repatriated and in chunks back to Canton for the maintenance of Hoqua's family. And that was, as I explained, decades of repatriation before it totally wound down. How did that work? Well, again, no contracts. It's actually quite interesting how the accounting was all done in Boston. Hoqua's family knew of it. Hoqua's family asked about it every now and then, but there was not an annual report that was written that would tally up for you the investments made and the market value thereof. I think what underwrote that was, one, Hoqua's family's personal connection with the Forbes, because the son was around when John Murray Forbes arrived in Canton for business. And equally importantly, Hoqua's family's business ties, at least in terms of investment, with Russell & Company, that continued on until the dissolution of Russell & Company itself. So many of these started when Hoqua was around, but the ongoing connections was what underwrote this blind trust. And of course, we can easily dismiss it as a quirky arrangement or whatnot, but then I'm reminded of my investment days, certain investment vehicles do not provide the same type of reports generated on a regular basis to the details that we have taken for granted on in general terms now. And this blind trust, the Swiss account of Hoqua, might have been peculiar at that moment in its transnational setting, but then if we were to appreciate it in the international world of today, maybe not as strange as it sounds at first sight.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think there are certainly parallels. But I think one important point that that you also highlight is, of course, that this also meant that capital was moved from one legal setting to yet another. Mm-hmm. And you did just mention the Qing state, that, of course, this was one way of diversifying risk and diversifying some of the capital and of the family firm and bringing it basically out of reach of the Qing state. So certainly that was also, I guess, an aspect of doing this, or an advantage of having some of the capital invested in the United States.
Yes, that's the advantage of working with business partners who can help you in a different jurisdiction. It's certainly the case with the Swiss bank account. It's also the case with some of the legal disputes that Hoqua's family got into with business concerns from England. So what they did was some foreign shopping when it came to legal resolutions, and Hoqua's family for some back payment of rents in Canton decided to take the case to Hong Kong, the British colony of Hong Kong. And that's only through the connections they had with the American partners. So in terms of investment, that's an advantage. In terms of legal resolution, that can be an advantage. And I would highlight that as quite a departure from the earlier period, especially when Hoqua decided not to pursue some of the legal cases in the U.S. But then later on, when these boundaries were becoming more solid, when the jurisdictional boundaries were becoming more solid, it became a resource in a different way as international standards were setting in and jurisdictions were becoming more rigid.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think, I just think that that's sort of another important point to sort of highlight. I would be remiss if I were not to to mention one more, I think, great strength of the book. And that is, of course, the wide range of sources that you've used. I think, I mean, if you just look at the bibliography, if we look at the footnotes, readers will see that you've sort of traced the story of Hoqua, you know, in Chinese archives, even in one archive in India, but in a whole range of American archives of different kind of personal collections. So I wanted to highlight this, that this is really sort of a tour de force of all kinds of different primary sources that we can think of that one could possibly use for this project. But I also wanted to ask you just how you went about sort of locating all these sources and how, the research in itself must have been quite transnational, obviously, in going after Hoqua, so to say.
Well, that's very kind of you to note that. But I would have to say, well, it's a stroke of luck that I chanced upon these particular archives. The locations were quite convenient for me, shall we say. I was going to the Baker Library of the Harvard Business School and Massachusetts Historical Society, basically after class, and spent months there looking things up. And then during term breaks, I traveled back to Hong Kong and the Pearl River Delta area to look at the Chinese side of the story. Of course, one cannot forget England, so I spent a couple of summers in London to look at the documents in the British Library and the National Archives in Kew. What's interesting about these sources, in addition to others that scatter in various places, is that we tend to think of business documents to belong to a single genre when they were not. I mean, I mentioned how the British records were, more of the formulaic entries, business entries. You look at the Chinese documents. What I found, they were compiled and printed in genres not necessarily reflecting their commercial origins. For example, you have anthologies of containing some of these documents, including the family, the household division in Hoqua's family early on when he needed to sort things out with his various brothers. And of course, we have Chinese business organizations structured with the idiom of family association. So, I was looking at genealogies. Whereas in the American case, you have more of these personal documents that would tell you a different side of the story in addition to the numbers. So it's actually fascinating to be looking at these various documents to think about how the different trading partners approached this very transnational network of exchange and how they maintained, how they sustained the commercial transactions for such a long time.
Yeah. That's but again, absolutely. But again, I think this really needs to be highlighted to sort of collect all these sources, find them in all these distant places, and then bringing them together. I think certainly for a story, that's always sort of the fun part of the research, or one of the most interesting parts of the research. But still, it should just be highlighted, the vast array of archives that are coming together in your book. I thought sort of before we close, whether you could, at least about the book, talk a bit about how you would situate sort of this case of Hoqua in your book within our sort of larger understanding of global trade in the period you are looking at. Because I think you make quite a powerful argument about that, particularly in your conclusion. And I think highlighting that would be good at this point here.
Sure. What I wanted to do in the book was to restore some understanding of Canton as a dynamic nexus of trade in that particular period, which it was, and it served its function for almost a century. And I think that is especially important today as our international, that's West-centric standards, are becoming increasingly insufficient to contain our transnational exchange, especially when China once again assumes center stage in today's environment. So it is important for us to understand the fluidity of the system which Canton represented in the absence of an international system that was supposed to regulate everything among the various trading partners. And that what came after Hoqua and the Canton system was but a construct fashioned by a certain group of business interests. And that's not necessarily the only option. So in today's environment, we need to acknowledge the interests and the dynamics of different groups and maybe approach with more agility today's environment as we negotiate a new course for global business flows.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, I think, and yeah, again, you bring this out. I think also what we can learn sort of about global trade today from the Hokwa story and the Canton system, you bring it out quite strongly, in the particularly in the conclusion. So, John, we've already taken up quite a lot of your time, but I thought before we close, we of course all want to know what you're working on now that the book is done. And you've dealt so much with Hokwa. What is your current research or next project on?
Oh, thanks for asking. Well, I have continued with the theme of transnational flows in and through the Pearl River Delta area, Greater Bay Area, and this time I've moved downstream from Canton or Guangzhou to Hong Kong. And from the 19th century to post-World War II developments in Hong Kong. And in particular, I'm looking at the development of the commercial aviation industry in Hong Kong. And what I'm finding is that the making of Hong Kong into an international aviation hub was not preordained. It went through many rounds of political developments. It was animated by many economic drivers and technological breakthrough. So it is yet another story of the constant rewiring of transnational flows through the region here in Hong Kong, the Greater Bay Area, Pearl River Delta area, with geopolitical shifts, economic developments, technological advancements, and sometimes unanticipated incursions by such issues as a pandemic, which we are going through right now. So business will continue. People, goods, capital, ideas will continue to flow through this region. But how? Hopefully this other episode of my historical accounts would give us some clues.
Oh, fantastic. Wonderful. That sounds like a really great project. And we certainly all look forward to learning more about that in the future. But before we close, I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to talk to me today and for being on the show today. I really enjoyed talking to you. So thank you and take care.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. And I welcome feedback and queries from our listeners.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.